Our second case this morning is case number 57397, Fong versus MGM. Mr. Marks for Ms. Fong and Mr. Hicks for the MGM. Mr. Marks.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Marks. I'm here with Adam Levine, and it's our privilege to represent Ms. Fong, who is the plaintiff and is obviously the appellate here. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of time. As you're aware, gaming's proliferated across the country and across the world, and it's really important that high-level executives like Ms. Fong have the confidence that their contracts, the plain meaning of their contracts, will be enforced by this court. Nevada law is still, Nevada is the epicenter of the gaming industry, and Nevada law is used in most contracts with high-level executives. Ms. Fong here had a negotiated contract that provided very limited grounds for her termination. She had to commit major misconduct before she could be terminated. She was supposed to be provided notice and an opportunity to cure any alleged job deficiencies. In this case, MGM terminated her without notice, with an absolute failure to comply in any way, shape, or form with the four corners of her written employment contract. Additionally, Nevada has always followed statutory interpretation of enforcing the plain meaning of Nevada statutes. NRS 613-210 is a very plain statute that requires, upon the request of an employer to give a truthful reason for their termination. I think you can all appreciate in the gaming industry how incredibly important it is to have that truthful reason. Because while unsatisfactory job performance may be in some instances a grounds for termination, it wasn't under this contract. People want to continue to be employed, and if you're accusing somebody of poor job performance, that's a totally different concept than accusing them of misconduct, of a gaming nature, embezzlement, cheating, that kind of thing. And that's why that statute is within the blacklisting provision. The arbitrator in this case manifestly disregarded that law, 613-210. He basically ignored it. He was given that law. We filed a motion for summary judgment asking him to enforce that law, and he totally disregarded that law. Numerous times, Ms. Fong was said poor job performance or unsatisfactory job performance in the performance evaluation, in her PAN, in her termination letter, in her personnel file. She was never once accused of anything that would lead to MGM losing their gaming license. And I think it's ludicrous that anybody here really believes that this case, which probably no one's ever heard of, MGM could have in any way, shape, or form have lost their gaming license. The evidence at the arbitration, there was no high-level executives ever came. No CFOs, no CEOs, no high-level casino executives came to the arbitration and stated MGM's in jeopardy of losing their gaming license. There was no evidence of anything in their compliance committee that had the dean of the Boyd Law School, it had prominent attorneys. Nothing was ever produced in which MGM was in jeopardy of losing their gaming license. MGM's a publicly traded company. If MGM was ever in danger of losing their license, even close to it, they'd have to report in their quarterly or annual reports through the SEC to their shareholders. Never once did any of that happen. Now, international gaming is a very unique situation. You may go to a casino, we all may go to a casino and not be able to get $1,000 of credit. But these international customers, especially from Asia, are lured to Las Vegas with no assets in the state of Nevada, no bank accounts in the state of Nevada, very little assets that you can see. They sign markers with accounts that everyone in the industry knows do not have the money to meet the markers. For instance, these million-dollar players don't ever have $1 million in a bank account. Their high roll is for a reason. They're invested internationally and overseas. So there's no way that they would ever have that money. In the annual reports, the casino loses anywhere from $50 to $60 million a year in these markers, and $30 million a year could come from the Far East. But why would they do that? Why would they give credit to all these people that have no accounts or assets in the state of Nevada? And why would they take the risk of losing that money? Because in their reports, they indicate that they make hundreds of millions of dollars over a given year. And obviously, in doing international marketing, it is very easy for that marketing person to be set up. It's very easy in dealing in different languages, currencies, et cetera, for there to be questions. And that's why Ms. Fong's contract was so important to her, because having been in the industry for 10 to 12 years, she wanted to make sure she wasn't secretly or surreptitiously fired or fired for reasons that she could not rebut or know about. Additionally, in this case, the arbitrator manifestly disregarded the law regarding the evidentiary issues regarding gaming records. The MGM can't just send records to gaming and create a privilege. The privilege is for defamation. The privilege can't convert a business record that would be a normal record in evidence in a state court into a privileged document for it being sent to gaming. And additionally,
Did you ask the arbitrator to rule to that effect? And I know you filed a motion in limine with respect to, or a motion to compel with respect to certain records, but did you go forward when the Gaming Control Board asserted privilege with respect to certain documents? Did you ask the arbitrator and argue to him, as you're arguing to us, that that statute creates a libel or defamation privilege, not an evidentiary type privilege?
Correct. We argued it, but you have to understand the posture of the case. At that point,
you argued it, but did you ask him to rule on it, or did you after?
We argued that it was a defamation statute and didn't apply, but we were assured, based on his in-camera inspection, that those were limited records that had nothing to do with our case. The problem was, because there are no pleadings in arbitration, there's no affirmative defenses, that on the 15th day of the arbitration, the arbitrator allowed two attorneys to step forward for MGM, not a CFO, not a CEO, not an executive, to say we at the time, 3 years later, had, quote, regulatory concerns. And at that point, I again objected, saying you're now violating Myers v. District Court and getting into allowing MGM to have shielded certain records and now used it as a sword. At the time we initially filed the motion and argued it in limine, everyone thought this was a just cause case under 10.1 and Section 22. And we were assured by the arbitrator on his in-camera review that those records had nothing to do with our issue. We didn't then appeal that to district court based on his assurance in good faith and the posture of the case. We were sandbagged on the last day of this arbitration because at that point, under Section 7, for the first time, evidence was allowed to be presented. But if you look at the record, that evidence really is a sham. Anybody can get up and say anything that I had concerns. There was no substantial evidence that you would need if your license was ever in jeopardy. Just think about it. If this casino's license was ever at all in jeopardy, there would be reams of paper that would not be privileged. It would be in the media. It would be business records. So they were allowed on the last day of the arbitration, through counsel, not even a corporate executive, to express, quote, concerns, and that was enough for the arbitrator to rule in their favor under Section 7. It's a total misuse of the Nevada law on evidence in terms of privilege. It totally manifestly disregards that gaming statute, which has nothing to do with use of privilege of business records. And that's just one in a multitude of manifest disregards of Nevada law. The arbitrator also disregarded our law in Nevada on contracts. If you have a contract that says give notice, the arbitrator just assumed on his own that that was immaterial, citing law from Massachusetts. That's not the law of the state of Nevada. You have always taken a strict view of notice requirements in the statute. You've never just said we can abandon those requirements. So the arbitrator found that none of the disregards by MGM, their failure to give any notice, their failure to tell Ms. Fong what she did wrong, he excused and apologized for every one of those failures and claimed that those were all insignificant, totally manifestly disregarded black letter statutes that he said are unclear or I'm just not applying them, and ruled for MGM, and did so after he had a potential conflict. One of the witnesses in the case.
With respect to the notice argument, I noticed that Section 7 cross-references Section 10.1, which is a for-cause termination. Is it your position that even if it were a Section 7 termination, even if it had been done correctly under that, that Section 22's notice requirements would have applied to that section?
Sure, because it says if you're fired even for misconduct. Ms. Fong was very concerned because she's out in the field in Asia and knows what goes on in the industry more than we can ever know, that she would have to know in writing what the reason is. Even to get another job or for her own protection, that she would know I could go to another employer and say, okay, I'm fired because I didn't collect enough, or I'm fired because
So your position is that Section 7, with its language that in the employer's sole discretion and judgment, if it deems this to jeopardize its license or reputation, that notwithstanding that Section 7 license, it's subject to the Section 10.1 and 22.
That's the only logical meaning. That's the only logical meaning. But additionally, if someone said their license was in jeopardy, your cosmetology license, your nursing license, your medical license, your legal license, there would be a document that would suggest that is true. These arbitration awards can't be affirmed when there's not one piece of paper in a 10,000 piece of paper record and a 15-day trial or arbitration in which nobody came in. They called the CFO, but he didn't even testify.
Comment, though, also on Section 7's broader expanse, which refers not just to jeopardizing the license, but also the business, reputation, or license.
There was no evidence of any of that. And what's troubling is John Shigley was a corporate CFO who came in on another issue and never testified that he believed his business or reputation. Even when it's in their sole discretion, all your case law suggests that has to be in good faith utilized. And the other thing is we showed at the arbitration that the whole basis of this case was an $800,000 math error that the collections manager and John Shigley made, that they called her a rogue employee before they ever interviewed her because they made an error. And I think you all can appreciate how hard it is for lawyers to correct and find math errors, but we did it. We found that their own accounting department made an error which set them down in a course where they accused her of being a rogue employee who abused their trust, and that was their basis. In fact, those three gamblers lost $1 million. They weren't kiting checks or taking money from MGM.
Mr. Marks, did you comment in interest of time on the disqualification of the arbitrator, the timing on that, how AAA dealt with it, and why you feel it's a viable issue for appeal?
Because with all these cases going to arbitration and high-level executives going to arbitration, there are no rules. In other words, we found out that, like, a couple of days before the arbitration that Mr. Gordon had been the attorney, his firm had been the attorney for Madam Chiang, who in our view was a witness that would have explained a lot of various transactions, and that Mr. Gordon's own wife had worked for Madam Chiang. Madam Chiang was only not only a client, but a very good friend, maybe one of the best friends of our client. We have no idea what extrajudicial comments, statements, culture that he may have found out about. AAA doesn't tell you. There's no affidavit as in state court on disqualification. We have no idea what went on behind closed doors, who ruled, or what the standard was. And in light of these rulings, we spent 15 days arguing was there just cause or not under the contract. And Mr. Gordon's continual saying, as he did in his decision, doesn't MGM have a right to be wrong? Doesn't MGM have a right to be wrong? Certainly calls into question his partiality, because when you say that, you're effectively saying I'm leaning towards the company and I'm looking for ways to rule for them, regardless of the fact they violated Nevada statute and they violated the plain meaning of the contract. That's why we're so concerned, and there's no judicial process to try to deal with disqualifications of arbitrators who are now handling multi-million-dollar cases, especially in Clark County.
Thank you.
I'd like to reserve unless there's any questions. Thank you.
Ms. Marks, I'll give you your full 3 minutes, and Ms. Tricks, I'm going to give you 17 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That'll be the other two that I'm giving back to Mr. Marks. 17 minutes, please.
Chief Justice Cherry, fellow justices, my name is Patrick Hicks. I'm joined by my colleague, Deborah Westbrook. Essentially, what Mr. Marks is asking this court to do is step in and substitute itself for the arbitrator by reevaluating the evidence, reevaluating the credibility of the witnesses, and basically doing a do-over, if you will. However, this court has articulated on many occasions, including the Bowman case and the Clark County School District case, that this court will not and cannot reevaluate the credibility of evidence, reweigh the evidence, but there are very strict standards. And the first, which Mr. Marks referred to, was the manifestly disregard of the law standard. That's a very high standard, one that this court in the Bowman decision characterized as a virtually insurmountable standard. And in order to meet that standard, the appellant is required to show that Andy Gordon knew about a well-defined, explicit, and clearly applicable law, and that he specifically and deliberately ignored that law. It is not enough, as Mr. Marks is asking this court to do, to conclude that Andy Gordon misapplied or misinterpreted the law, which we don't believe he did in any way, shape, or form. That's a very high standard, and it's not one that can be met by the appellant. With regard to the second basis for the...
Well, before you move off of that,
yes.
What do you do with his argument that even treating this as a Section 7 termination, his client was entitled to written notice and presumably an opportunity to refute it before you proceeded to terminate her, and that's a manifest disregard of well-settled contract principles when you violate a written notice requirement such as that?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would refer Mr. Marks to his own argument, which is the plain meaning of the contract. Section 7 does not have a notice provision. Section 7, as Tom Peterman, the general counsel of the company, testified at the arbitration and Andy Gordon heard, is a critical provision. It's in all of their agreements. It's a standalone good cause provision that specifically gives the company the right to terminate Ms. Fong's employment if the company believes in its sole discretion that she has been, she is, or she will be involved in conduct that could, among other things, threaten the company's license. Now, Mr. Marks said there was absolutely no evidence at the hearing of that, and that the company didn't call any senior executives. Well, that doesn't square with what the record says. Mr. Peterman testified at length, subject to grueling cross-examination by Mr. Marks, as to his concerns when Ms. Fong sat in a room with four individuals, and she admitted that she allowed a cash out for the purpose of allowing a gentleman named Fang to pay off, for Mr. Pang to pay off an internet sports bet. And in addition to Tom Peterman, Ellen Whittemore, outside experienced gaming counsel, testified that when she heard that, she was immediately concerned. The testimony in the record was also that...
What do you do with this explicit reference in Section 7 to Section 10.1, which sure. In turn is a for-cause termination, which then, to my mind, would put in Section 22?
Okay, very, very, very good question, Jenner. Section 10.1 is the provision, as you said, that provides for good cause, which provides that if the company terminates employment pursuant to Section 10.1, there's no further obligation for payments. Section 22 has a separate definitional section, various terms that are defined there, including good cause. But Section 7 stands on its own. It's an independent good cause definition if the company is concerned in its sole discretion. And that is the grounds upon which arbitrator Gordon ruled in this case. Now, with regard to Section 22, we would argue, as arbitrator Gordon concluded in any event, that notice would have been an immaterial term and therefore a non-material breach, because this wasn't a situation where Ms. Fong could have an opportunity to cure. She'd already engaged in the misconduct. She couldn't go back and cure it. But importantly, this case was decided by Andy Gordon on Section 7. Section 7 says, as the court pointed out, specifically refers to 10.1. If we decide in our sole discretion that you have been, are, or will be engaged in conduct that could threaten our license, then we have the right to terminate you per Section 10.1, which means no further obligation to pay. The second general argument that Mr. Marks makes and asks this court to set aside the arbitrator's award is based on the arbitrary capricious standard. And essentially, in order to prevail on that, it is the appellant's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that arbitrator Gordon's holding was not supported by substantial evidence. And they can't come anywhere near meeting that very strict standard on appeal. Arbitrator Gordon, for 15 days, heard witnesses. The parties were allowed to put on any witnesses they wanted. We were both allowed to cross-examine witnesses, to offer exhibits into evidence. In fact, there were 188 separate exhibits representing thousands of pages of documents. And Arbitrator Gordon concluded some really important things there that unquestionably constitute substantial evidence. Number one, he concluded that the four individuals who testified that Aaron Fong admitted allowing a cash out for an illegal purpose, that they were telling the truth. The appellant, Aaron Fong, testified that they were all lying. And Andy Gordon didn't buy that. He made a credibility determination and he weighed the evidence. Secondly, Andy Gordon heard the testimony of General Counsel Tom Peterman. He heard the testimony of outside counsel Ellen Whittemore, who both said, as soon as she said that, we had licensing concerns. And he heard the testimony of Al Facento Jr., who was her boss, who testified when he was advised as to the admission that she had made and the legal ramifications, he too was concerned about the company's license. So there was clearly substantial evidence for Andy Gordon to conclude that the company was concerned about its license. And now, after the fact, counsel really is simply asking this court to reinterpret that as opposed to meeting the exacting standards that the Nevada Supreme Court has set up with regard to arbitrary and capricious, which they come nowhere near meeting. The court asked about the disqualification issue, and if it pleases the court, I'm going to go ahead and address that. I'm happy to address anything the court wants to know about, but I want to try to make sure I address in the time that I have the things that the court asked about. First of all, it's really important to note, and this is in the record. Appellant Aaron Fong claims that the disqualification stems from this witness named Madam Chong. Madam Chong was a friend of the appellant's. And Madam Chong apparently was represented by McDonald Toronto and Andy Gordon's firm many years ago. Well, in the appeal, counsel notes that his client, Aaron Fong, many years, approximately 8 years before we agreed to arbitration in this case, paid the bill of Madam Chong, wrote a check to the McDonald Toronto law firm. Think about that for a minute. That means Aaron Fong knew when we selected Andy Gordon to be the arbitrator in this case, that her good friend, Madam Chong, had used the services of Andy Gordon and McDonald Toronto. Yet what happens here? 4 days before the arbitration's to begin, they file a motion to disqualify Andy Gordon. And they were heard fully on it. We responded. AAA had the responsibility to make a decision and to make one at that time because the arbitration was beginning to start. So the argument that they didn't know about this potential conflict or this potential representation until the last minute is just pure silly, and it flies in the face of the arguments they've made on appeal. If there are any other questions on the disqualification either now or as I proceed, I'm happy to address that. But I wanted to make sure the court was fully aware of that fact.
Does the AAA agreement govern how motions to disqualify are dealt with?
It does, Your Honor, and it's interesting in this case because if there's ever a case before this court, I would think this is as strong a case as possible to uphold the arbitrator's award. And the reason I say that is this. Here, the parties actually stipulated to arbitration at the commencement of litigation. The parties in 2003 agreed that AAA rules would apply, but when Ms. Fong's employment ended, Mr. Marks, on behalf of his client, and I, on behalf of my client, entered a stipulation, and the stipulation specifically said we agree to be governed by the AAA rules, and we specifically want Annie Gordon to be our arbitrator. And the AAA rules, this court can rest assured, have lots of due process in them. The rules in question here have incorporated a set of protocols, due process protocols, which have been supported and endorsed by a variety of organizations, from plaintiffs' counsel to the defense bar, to various mediation and conciliation services, to the ACLU, to a variety of organizations. And as this court pointed out in the Armstrong, Thomas and Armstrong versus City of North Las Vegas case, If the parties agree to a particular set of rules, those should be the rules that apply in their particular case. And the parties here agreed, when represented by counsel, that the AAA rules would apply. And under the AAA rules, the parties had a right to present why they thought the arbitrator should be disqualified or shouldn't be disqualified, and that the decision by AAA was binding and conclusive. So yes, they did apply. And I would argue, in fact, I would turn this due process argument on its head. I think it would be a violation of due process if the parties, especially when represented by competent counsel, agree to a set of rules, and then when the whole process is over and they don't like the result, they want to go back and do a redo and change the rules.
So is it your position that the arbitration rules deeming this conclusive, the AAA's determination conclusive, makes that issue entirely unreviewable by this court?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. We have two arguments. One is, and we rely on this court's opinion and Thomas and Armstrong, that deference should be given to the rules that the parties have selected. Our second argument, of course, is that there was no actual bias in this case. The argument that counsel made on appeal is that there was evident partiality. Well, here, because it was a disclosure case, the standard that appellant has to meet is that there was actual bias. And again, that's a very high standard. The standard for
What is our standard of review on the disqualification issue?
Sure. In an actual bias case, the Thomas and Armstrong case was a non-disclosure case. This court has not ruled on what the specific standard should be in an actual bias case. And this court has, however, in the Thomas and Armstrong opinion, cited to a case that we cite to in our briefs, which is the Woods versus Saturn Distribution Company case, which is a Ninth Circuit opinion, cited by this court and Thomas and Armstrong with approval. And what we would advocate, to answer your question directly, Your Honor, is that this court adopt the same standard, and that is, in order to show actual bias, the appellant must prove, number one, that Andy Gordon had an improper motive, and number two, that Andy Gordon had a personal stake in the outcome of that arbitration. Now, appellant admits in their own briefs that they don't have any evidence to support those propositions and cannot come anywhere near to meeting the standard that they need to show evident partiality, which is what they've argued on appeal.
Could you address the statute with respect to the gaming privilege?
Sure, NRS section 463. And again, let me address that directly, but I want to take a step back and put it into context. And remember, the argument that counsel is making is that Andy Gordon manifestly disregarded the law. He knew about a clear, explicit, applicable law, and he just decided he wasn't going to apply. Not that he misapplied it. 463, to answer your question, Your Honor. My client was fully aware, as those in the gaming industry are fully aware, that the Nevada Gaming Control Board interprets Section 463 very broadly, and that they're very serious about this, and that they interpret communications between, among others, licensees and the Nevada Gaming Control Board as being privileged, absolutely privileged. And in this case, and it's very important, Arbitrator Gordon issued an interim order. An interim order. Had a discovery order. And in that discovery order, as it relates to this gaming control privilege, he, at oral argument amongst the parties and counsel, told us, we don't think you, this is Arbitrator Gordon, says, I don't think you, the MGM, holds this privilege. I think the Nevada Gaming Control Board holds this privilege. And because the Nevada Gaming Control Board holds this privilege, the Nevada Gaming Control Board should be given an opportunity to weigh in. So he issued an interim order. And in that order, he said, which is part of the record, I'm going to let the Nevada Gaming Control Board weigh in on this. And if the Nevada Gaming Control Board wants to interpose the objection to any documents, I am going to give the lawyers an opportunity to fully brief the issue and then to be heard. The Nevada Gaming Control Board came back through the Attorney General's office and objected to a handful of documents. At that point, counsel for the appellant made a strategic decision, and that was they're not going to challenge this. They did not ask at that point to have briefs done, even though Arbitrator Gordon indicated he was willing to do it. They did not ask to have oral argument on this. They made a strategic decision not to do that. In other words, the appellant and her counsel never asked Arbitrator Gordon to interpret 463, and therefore it is impossible on appeal to be able to argue that Arbitrator Gordon manifestly disregarded the law by knowing about a clear, explicit law and deliberately not applying it. They didn't ask him to. And that's what they needed to do in order for this issue even to get teed up to make the argument. Now, to go back to that, Your Honor, with regard to 463, we know that the Nevada Gaming Control Board interprets the statute very broadly, and in fact, coincidentally, just a couple of days after Arbitrator Gordon issued this interim order in a totally different case, it was a case involving John L. Smith and Sheldon Adelson in the Las Vegas Sands, the Nevada Gaming Control Board made the same objection and argued that the 463 provides for an absolute privilege and records between licensee and Nevada Gaming Control Board should not be produced. But we don't even have to go to the John L. Smith case to determine whether or not the Nevada Gaming Control Board feels that way. We know in this case the Nevada Gaming Control Board sent a letter to Arbitrator Gordon about a limited number of documents and referenced that statute and said that they were objecting. Now, counsel made mention that Arbitrator Gordon reviewed these documents. He didn't review these documents. That's totally unsupported by the record. Arbitrator Gordon had the documents provided to the Nevada Gaming Control Board, and then Mr. Marks never asked Arbitrator Gordon to do anything with it further.
Could you comment on Mr. Marks' argument that it was terribly unfair because there was a shift in approach to your termination here, making those documents much more relevant than they would have appeared to have been?
Yes, and I thank you for reminding me of that. Essentially, and I'll be brief, essentially, do I have 2 more minutes or 3 minutes?
No, you have your time's up, but go ahead.
Okay, I'll just give
Mr. Marks a little extra time.
Sure. Essentially, Mr. Marks, today and as well as in the pleadings, argued that this was sprung on them at the hearing. Not true. In September of 2008, we briefed the Section 7 argument in opposition to one of their early filed motions in limine. Well, that was 8-9 months prior to the hearing. In May of 2009, still 2 full months before the hearing, we also briefed the Section 7 argument as it related to a motion regarding their expert witness. And then prior to the hearing, in our pre-hearing brief, we laid out the Section 7 argument. So the notion that Section 7 was sprung at the last minute isn't supported by the record, and it's not accurate. On behalf of my client and my colleague, Deborah Westbrook, I'd like to thank all of the court for the questions and for the opportunity to be heard.
Thank you, Mr. Hicks. Mr. Marks, give you 4 minutes. Give him an extra minute. You have 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, counsel is remarkably silent on 613.210. You just can't ignore that statute, and that's what Arbitrator Gordon did. He just took a Nevada statute that most of our case was based on, that unsatisfactory job performance, and just said, I'm not applying it. And you just can't do that. He just ignored all of contract law regarding notice provisions. Why have these contracts if they're not going to be enforced? She negotiated and wanted to know, if you say I did something wrong, I need to know. I need an opportunity to cure. They're talking about this cash out. The evidence at the arbitration that we provided, there's tens of millions of dollars a year of cash outs. That's a judgment call by a vice president. That's something you would get in writing, we disagree with your cash out, and be allowed to contest it. That's exactly why she wanted these contracts, because every day she has to make these million-dollar decisions. And this is all after the fact. After they never read her contract, after they terminated for poor job performance, after they have absolutely no records showing any licensing issues at all. They can call all the attorneys they want, but they don't have anyone from the company with one piece of paper, one napkin. Don't leave your common sense at the courthouse door. We tell juries, don't leave your common sense. If they ever had a licensing issue under Section 7, where's the evidence? And responding to Justice Pickering, if he really, Gordon, in good faith, was using Section 7, which says business reputation and jeopardy of your license, why not analyze each one of them, or any of them, or all three of them? He spends no time. He just says, I think it's reasonable that they had licensing concerns. Licensing concerns don't prove by a preponderance of the evidence that your business, your reputation, or your license was in jeopardy. the evidence just wasn't there at all. Regarding the disqualification, I agreed to AAA because that's what the contract said. I didn't out of thin air agree. The contract says AAA and the national rules, so we had to do it. But here's the problem. 4 days before the arbitration, Andy Gordon gives his disclosure that he knows the witness and that his wife worked for this witness. And this witness was a very close friend of our client, et cetera. Our client had no clue about this check. She didn't know anything 8 years earlier. We asked for a full-scale hearing. We filed a motion to disqualify on short notice. We asked for a full-scale hearing. It was denied without oral argument. We didn't have a full opportunity to argue it. There was no counter-affidavit by Mr. Gordon. We have no idea who at AAA made the decision. So we're asking the court to set some rules, because if you're going to arbitrate multi-million dollar cases, how do you know behind closed doors these relationships? How do you know when you get this disclosure by Mr. Gordon, the extent of it? We had no opportunity, as you would in state court, to get the affidavit back or have any sort of hearing. And most importantly, you don't know at AAA who's making these decisions. You don't know if they're even a lawyer. You have a case manager. You're on the phone. You get a minute order that says deny, and that was it. And that's troubling when you see every ruling and basically ignoring, absolutely ignoring, without any attempt to justify 613-10, the well-established notice provisions in contract law that any law student knows, and Mr. Gordon just absolutely ignores them without any analysis in his opinion that really casts doubt on his partiality. And if he was going to rule on Section 7, he needed to have some analysis of Section 7 beyond, I just find that they called two attorneys who said there were licensing concerns.
Mr. Marks, do you agree with counsel's suggestion that the standard this court would use if it reached the disqualification issue is the standard contained in the Ninth Circuit court case of Marks versus Saturn?
I thought it would be the Chapter 38 standard, the Nevada statutory standard for arbitrations under Chapter 38.
What would be the basis for doing so?
The fact that it's in Chapter 38, the Nevada arbitration rules. Or,
but the rules that have been adopted by the parties in this case are AAA.
Correct, but AAA had effectively no standard. In other words, there was no minimal hearing. There was no chance for us to rebut anything. There was no affidavit by arbitrator Gordon. In other words, we get on the eve of trial, hey, this person was a client. My wife worked for this witness. Do you have a problem? We immediately say, yes, we have a problem. We were never allowed to go beyond that, and I think we're entitled at a minimum to know who made the decision. We don't even know who at AAA, if anyone, made the decision denying it. You have to look at that in accordance with his decision when you read his decision analysis of Section 7 and also the fact that he just disregarded contract law and NRS 613-10. You can't just disregard 613-10 because you don't like it or because it's a statute that very few people deal with every day. He just manifestly disregarded it. I mean, I think if any case cries out for the manifest disregard standard, this is it, because these issues were briefed, were argued, he was told about it, and he constantly said, don't they have a right to be wrong? And it's our position when you make an $800,000 math error like that, and that's what leads them to accuse our client of being a rogue employee after 10 years of meritorious service, the MGM doesn't have a right to be wrong. They have to follow the plain meaning of the statute and the plain meaning of Nevada contract law.
Thank you. Thank both of you. The court thanks both of you for your fine arguments, fine briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.